Thank you, Jerome. My name is Joe Gray, and I'm an alcoholic. Because of a loving God that works in the program and the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink of alcohol since August 27th, 1988. I'm as grateful as I know how to be for that period of sobriety. Thank you, Jerome. Thank you, Vicksburg Group of AA. This is wonderful. 25 or 26, whatever it is. I understand we Ken's having trouble counting them up. By the way, I hope Chris feels the same way when we get to, I get through talking as he did before we start, because he might have wished he went back in there. It's good to be here. It's good to see some old friends and see some new friends. It's always a privilege to be asked to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but especially when you're asked to come and stand behind one of these podiums and share your life. And I do appreciate this opportunity. Up until now, everything's been all right. As Jerome said, we've done a lot of eating and fellowshipping. Kind of reminds me of a story I heard once out in Texas about this little boy. He's about 6 years old, and he was the only child. He was born to this couple quite late in their life, and quite naturally he would be somewhat spoiled. And he was six and had never spoken a word. And his parents, of course, were quite doting over him. And one morning, as he was sitting at the breakfast table eating a bowl of oatmeal, his mother was standing at the kitchen sink washing dishes. She heard this: "This damned oatmeal is lumpy." God, it shocked her. She dropped her pots and pans. Dad was heading out the door. He dropped his briefcase on the floor and rushed to his side and caressed his little brow and said, "Oh, my God, son, you have finally spoken. What has taken you so long?" He said, "Up to now, everything's been all right." So I kind of understand that. Up to now, everything's been all right. I'm also glad that you all have Al-Anon participation at this anniversary. I love Al-Anons. I'm married to one of them. Y'all heard her this afternoon. She's commonly referred to as one of those black belt Al-Anons. She's one of those Al-Anons that tries to help me sometimes when I don't even want any help. I can remember a few years ago, our little four-year-old grandson was over at the house, and we were out in the backyard trying to get this kite up. And we'd run it across the yard, it'd get up about this high, and it'd fall. And we'd turn around and run it back across the yard and get it up about this high, and it'd fall. And I saw her standing over there at the kitchen window. And she commenced to rapping on the window, and I walked over there and said, "What is it?" She said, "You need more tails, you need more tails." I said, "I wish you'd make up your mind. Last night you told me to go fly a kite." You know, I guess I'm related to alcoholism about every way a person can be. I'm the grandson of an alcoholic. I'm the son of an alcoholic. I'm the nephew of several alcoholics, the cousin of several alcoholics. I'm the brother of three alcoholics, the stepfather of two alcoholics, and the father of at least one alcoholic. Now, I don't tell you that to impress you. And I'm not an alcoholic because of my relationship to any of those people. I'm an alcoholic because I drank too much alcohol. I did it all by myself. No one ever held me down and poured alcohol down my throat. I volunteered for every drink I ever took. I probably broke in line for some of them. I'm sure it is. And that's just the way it is. So I have nothing or no one else to blame for being alcoholic. I know when I got here, I wanted to blame somebody. It had to be somebody. I'm from the old Archie Bunker school. Somebody has got to be at fault here. But it's just not the case with me. You know, we're asked to tell in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. You know, we spend a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous telling each other what it was like and what happened. And we're not the only ones that are stuck on that phrase, "what happened." That's a pretty common phrase. You know, I used to ask a lot of people when I'd see them come in and stay sober a while, they'd go back out and get drunk, and they'd come back if they made it back, and I'd walk up to them and I'd ask them, "What happened? What happened? What happened just before you went out and took that drink?" Well, the common answers were these: "I quit going to meetings. I quit reading the big book. I quit calling a sponsor. I quit praying. And I forgot how to stay sober." And that seemed to be the general theme of everyone. But we're not the only one that uses that question. What happened? If we could hear a grinding car crash right out here on the highway, one of us would run up there and ask, what happened? Or you hear somebody out here in the kitchen drop a big tray of dishes and it has a big crash, and somebody run in there and ask, what happened? Well, do you remember about 2,000 years ago when the Master walked the earth? And he healed the blind man, and someone walked up and said, what happened? He said, I don't know. Once I was blind, and now I see. You ask me what happened? I don't know. Once I was drunk, and now I'm sober. I tell you what I think happened to me. I think Alcoholics Anonymous happened to me. And I know because Alcoholics Anonymous happened to me, God had an opportunity and a chance to work in my life. And I believe that's what happened. And this is my story. I was born in a little town not too far from here, up in North Mississippi, up in Winona. Some of you may be familiar with that little town. I've been gone from there a long time. That's where I started. And I think at one time, I was probably normal when I was about 5 years old. I can't remember much being wrong back then. And then I fell in love with an older woman. Her name was Susan. She was 6 and I was 5. And we were underneath her front porch steps one day playing show and tell or feel and squeal or something. And her mother called us, and she drug us out from underneath those steps, and of course we didn't have any clothes on. And she looked down at me and she said, Joe Gray, if you continue to do this, your thing will fall off. I took a look down at Susan. I guess she had done it before. Hers had done fell off. And her mother took me down to my house, which was just a few houses away, and marched me in the kitchen and told my mother what she'd caught us doing. And then she left. And my mother said, did you do that? I said, no, ma'am, it wasn't me. And I know she didn't believe that. But I'll tell you what I learned that day. I learned that if you tell a lie and somebody believes it, it's not a lie anymore. And I convinced myself of that all the way up into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the way I lived my life. The truth wasn't important. Also, I can remember about that time some of those other defects of character started coming to light. You know, I've heard it many times in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sure you have too, about the dishonesty of the alcoholic. Well, let me tell you something. I got here, I believe, for as much for my thinking as I did for my drinking. And that crooked thinking started long before I had a drink. And I don't know why. I can't blame it on anything. It's just the way it was. I remember when I started to school, I felt different. I've heard it described at these podiums how different we felt. Well, I did. I was the tallest kid in my class. I looked different from that aspect, being taller, but I also looked different from one other aspect. My mother dressed me in a pair of hand-me-down knickers from my cousin. And I don't know if anybody, of course, I guess they're probably pretty popular today on the golf tour anyway. I'd probably wear a pair of them today, but boy, I didn't like them then. I was the only kid in school that had a pair of them, and they were corduroy. And when you took a step, you know, you'd walk, those cords would ripple, and I could hear you coming a long way off, and so I knew I was different. You know, back then, and something else I had going for me, and I don't know where I got it, what happened, but I had a bad attitude. I don't know the reason for that. I can't lay my finger on it, but I had a bad attitude. I guess the only thing that I needed was a drink of alcohol. And I've heard it said in these podiums lots of times, took a drink when I was in the second grade. Well, I didn't. I probably could have used one, but that's not when I had it. I had my first drink when I was 15 years old. Me and Eddie Howard and Stooky Curtis went out to the county line, and I bought a six-pack of Busch Bavarian beer. That's how long ago it's been. It's called it Bavarian then. I drank all 6 of them, and the next thing I know, we're in a truck stop, and I'm arm wrestling a truck driver. I don't know why. To this day, I don't know why. It was a hot June night. I remember that. And I got sick, and I went outside and threw up, and I laid down in the back seat of that old 49 Plymouth. And a little while later, they came out, and they said, let's go home. I said, oh, let's go back to the county line and get some more beer. And they didn't want to go, but they took me. And I don't remember how many of those next six-pack I drank. It didn't matter because I'd made my point. They were a couple of panty wastes. I could drink, throw up, and go drink some more, and them cats couldn't do it. So that's what I did. I wanted to be different. I wanted to hold myself out to be different. And I did a good job of that. I went through high school without too much fanfare. I stole as much as I could to drink on. We used to steal things. We started out stealing things like car batteries. It was easy in those days. You didn't have the hood latches weren't on the inside of the car. They were on the outside of the car. And you could walk by and pop the hood, get a battery, and you're gone. Of course, the overhead got a little much because you spill a little battery acid on your Levi's and your mother would wash them and big holes would come out and over hard to explain. So we started stealing other stuff and started stealing scrap iron. And we'd steal, if it wasn't nailed down or welded somewhere, it was ours. Yard art, it didn't make any difference. It was ours. We'd haul it to Red Austin's scrap yard over across town and sell it. And Red's an old fellow, and he'd say, take it back to the back, boys, and dump it out. And we'd take it back there by the fence, dump it out, go get our money, drive around the block, crawl on the fence, drag it out of mother, put it on the truck, and take it around and sell it to him again. We wasn't even smart enough to get him something different. We'd sell him the same stuff over and over. You know, we had a kind of grew on us, you know. So that's what we did, and drank every chance we could, stealing and doing the things we had to do to get something to drink. Well, I failed an algebra and history class and had to go to summer school and take it that summer. And I think it was a junior. Or if I didn't take it, they said, you're not going to play football next year. And that's the only reason I went to school was girls and football. I didn't care anything about anything else. My dad wouldn't send me, and I had my grandmother, I conned her, and sending me down to school. They gave his high school subject at a junior college down in Goodman. So that's where I went, summer school that summer. And I met an old boy by the name of T-Bone McCorkle. I'll never forget T-Bone. T-Bone's a little older than the rest of us guys. He just got out of the Air Force, and he had been going to school down there on a GI Bill. And T-Bone, the only guy I knew had a better ducktail than T-Bone was Elvis. T-Bone was a guy about this tall. He's cool. He had a pair of his camels rolled up in the sleeve of his T-shirt. He had a 56 Plymouth Fury, them gold check marks down the side of it. He had a Harley Davidson off at school as well. T-Bone was bad before that word bad was even invented. T-Bone liked to drink like I like to drink. So T-Bone now hooked it up, and we teamed up, and every day we'd go out and drink. The school got wind of my activities, and they called me in and said, if you get caught doing this again, and pal, you're out of here, you're taking a zero, and you will not be able to come back here. Well, I took them at the word, and I never got caught again. I'd go to bed, call out to Wonder, meet T-Bone at the corner, we'd go out and drink all night. Never did suffer much consequences of that. I could just drink, and it was just no big deal. I thought everybody drank that way, and we spent the whole summer that year lying to the women, drinking those honky-tonks, dancing to Kansas City out there on that hardwood dance floor. We wore a Kansas City record out one summer at that old bar. Nothing too much happened. I went back to finish high school, got a football scholarship to college, went off to college. Got the third week of fall practice, I hurt my knee and they wanted to operate on it. I knew the only guys that I knew that had knee surgery back in those days, most of them didn't play again. A lot of them couldn't even walk. And I said, you're not going to operate on my knee. You can have your scholarship back, and I'm going to Texas. I had an uncle who lived in Wichita Falls. He told me if something happened in college didn't work out, I always had a job with him. I didn't even know what he did. But here I head off to Texas, and it turns out that he was in the oil field equipment business. And he had in mind for me to drive an 18-wheeler hauling oil field equipment all over the country. So that's what it is. My drinking picked up. I drank all the time that I could. I drove one truck. This other fellow drove another truck, and we'd usually be hauling a drilling rig or something, so it'd take two of us. We'd have two trucks. I remember we were over in Tucumcari, New Mexico one day, and we had a little time, and so we weren't rushed, so we didn't sleep in those old sleeper cabs that night. We got a motel room. This room had two twin beds in it, and this guy went across the highway and got two quarts of Champion bourbon. And he came back, and he sat on one bed, and I sat on the other. We passed those jugs of Champion back and forth, watching the test pattern, not ever saying a word to each other. We were ordinary two people who ordinarily would not mix. Talks about this in the book. I could drink all night, stay up all night. It didn't bother me a whole lot. I was in good physical condition in those days. But I lived there for several months, and all of a sudden I'm in the middle of Arizona one night about 3 o'clock in the morning driving. Those long, straight highways. And the thought came to me, your love life sucks. You're out here on this highway all the time. Now, if you had a job in town, you wouldn't have to do this. The only thing I could justify that was the need to get married so I could justify having a job in town. I only had this one suspect. Been going out a few times. I got back home, and I told her this wonderful idea I had. She agreed. Showed you how sick she was. So we got married. And sure enough, I did. I quit that job and got a job in town. And 11 months after that marriage, we had our first child. And I was a pretty good husband for that first 11 months. I will have to say I was. I came home every night. I did the things that husbands are expected to do. After that baby was born, it was like somebody had turned on a light switch. I couldn't go home. Baby was about 2 months old. I just couldn't go home anymore. That bar, I worked at a place in this bar, a wonderful, wonderful bar. Kind of a French-sounding name. It's called the Wee Lounge. It wasn't anything French about it, I promise you. There was more smoke in there than it is in here, I'll tell you. And more stale beer on the carpet. Oh, man, I loved it. And it was right across the street from where I worked. And she had asked me in the morning, are you going to come home tonight? I'll be here at 6 o'clock. And I meant that when she asked me. When I said that, I meant it. But somehow, about 5 o'clock, the Wee Lounge would start calling my name. And I'd wind up over there. I can so identify with in Bill's story when he's beating on the bar saying, how did this happen again? I understand that. I've literally done it hundreds and hundreds of times. Didn't know why I did what I did. She would admonish me for drinking. If you loved me, she'd say, you wouldn't drink like this. And I loved her, I think, as much as I was capable. I remember one night I came in, or one morning, it was usually my practice coming in 3 or 4 o'clock when the bars closed. They closed at 2. And if I didn't have something better to do at 2, then I'd go home. Otherwise, I'd do something else. But this morning I wobbled in the front door, and I must have fallen because I remember she went in and woke that baby up, and she held the baby up over me, and the baby looked 8 feet tall, so I must have been on the floor. She said, if you love this baby, you wouldn't drink like this. And I loved that baby, and I couldn't keep from it, and I didn't know why. Did not have a clue. That was 1963. I could have used this program in 1963. Didn't know it existed. Probably wouldn't have come had I known it. You know what they say about us. We're just not ready to be ready. I've never seen anybody go looking for a solution to a problem they didn't know they had. Why would you? Why would you? And I sort of didn't think I had a problem. I'm the type of alcoholic who has that sixth sense right back here. Kay talks about her slots. Well, I got one of those. And I had one of those little tingles that day. And I went to work and I got fired. I was shocked and amazed that they would fire me. I love this job. And they explained to me that the reason they fired me, I was in charge of the inventory. And they'd come up missing with a bunch of hand tools, and they thought that I must know something about it. I was indignant. I was so angry and resentful at those people. How dare they fire me for just some suspicion? I didn't know anything about their hand tools. Now, I had been stealing money off their gasoline credit card for about a year and a half. But I could justify that. After all, they wouldn't pay me what I was worth. So what I told them was, okay, that's fine. I'll go to work for your competitor who would break your old company. And I came down to Louisiana and got a job with another one of their competitors. And I'm down here in the swamp, down here by Bordelandville, just doing the same thing I always did, drink and not go home, and do the things that we do out there in the places that we visit. Still couldn't go home. Couldn't see anything the matter, though. I've got a better job, making more money, driving a better car, drinking better whiskey, and drinking sometimes in better places. Couldn't see a thing going on here. I was over in Natchez, Mississippi one night, drunk, stayed out all night. The next day, I'm driving down the highway about noon. I go to sleep at the wheel, and I go off the road and total that car. Nothing much happened to me. I got a few stitches in my mouth, ignition key broke off my kneecap. That was about it. It's the only time in my life I'd ever had a seatbelt. They had just put seatbelts in all these company cars. As a matter of fact, that week they had put them in, that was the first time I'd had it on. Boy, it would probably kill me. Well, nothing changed in my life. I didn't see anything wrong there. Because I didn't see anything, the alcohol had anything to do with that. It's lack of sleep. Anybody could see that. I'd have been up all night. I'd made some friends, though, and I met a friend with Standard Oil Company out of Denver. And I was aware of my welcome out here, too. You know, you can only drink so much and only miss showing up at so many things, and people start looking at you funny. And so anyway, he said, you know, you need to come to Houston with me. He said, I want you to meet some people down there. And he had a industrial lube company down there that he sold to that hired a bunch of young guys. And so I went down there and I got a job with them. They hired me. And all of a sudden, I'm making better money, wearing better clothes, drinking better whiskey, drinking in better places. They had a box out at the Astrodome, gave me a handful of credit cards. A handful of private club cards. I said, listen, you take these and you take those customers and you buy them whiskey, you take them to the hunting lease, you take them to the Astrodome, we expect you to use these facilities. And I said, all right. I thought I'd die and go to heaven. I had customers like Hughes Tool Company and Reed Roller Bit Company and Big Three Welding and Tenneco Oil. And I'd buy a couple of cases of whiskey and give all them a couple of quarts apiece and leave the rest of it in the trunk of my car. And they thought they got a good deal. And I thought they did too. But it was just like a playground for an alcoholic like me. And I gotta loved it. Well, this company, we did real well for a while, and this company sold out to this Eastern company. And they came in there with their Ivy League suits and their three-piece suits, and they said, we'd like you boys to keep selling like you're selling, but you're going to have to cut out some of the expenses. But the thing that really got me is when we went to work there, they handed us all a handful of gasoline credit cards. Well, this new company, they wanted to kind of cut down in that area, so they put in their own pump, put in their own car wash, and they had a guy with a comp porter come around and leave your keys on your desk, and he'd come get your keys and take your car back and have the oil changed, have it washed. That's pretty nice. And they gave us these credit cards and said, you can have to start doing this yourself. I said, I'm indignant. That's the way you're going to treat us. I just quit. Just get me another job. So I did. Went across town, got me a job in an equipment company, selling heavy equipment. I did that for about 6 months, 8 months, or a year, something like that, and nothing changed. I'm still out drinking all I can drink every night. I still can't go home. And then they offered me an opportunity to transfer to Dallas with this company. And I went up to Dallas, took a look around for about 48 hours. And the guy that I was going to be working for there and all his salesmen were all about my age, and they'd like to do what I like to do, drink, and not go home to their wives either. And I took that transfer and I went to Dallas, and that was August of 1968. Up until that time, I had prided myself in not drinking before 5 o'clock. It was something about it. I thought, I don't know where I got it, but if somebody found out you was drinking before 5 o'clock, they might think you have a problem with alcohol. So I was very careful not to drink before 5. And but after I got to Dallas, my boss, he liked to go have a few drinks at lunch. Well, it's all right. Your boss, you with your boss, wasn't it? Sure. So I started drinking at noon. And I start drinking at 11, you know, kind of pushing that noon hour a little bit. And could not go home. But this time we had 3 kids. And some people ask me, how did you have 3 kids no more than you were home? And that's a pretty good question. Because I didn't go home that much. I was out partying, drinking. That was my life. That's all I wanted to do. I didn't care about anything or anybody else. And one day I was at my favorite watering hole. It was on a Friday afternoon. Remember it like it was yesterday. And the thought came to me, you know, your problem is you need to be single. that family is just holding you back. Now, I don't know how I could have been any more single than I was, you know. But anyway, I made that decision, and old Norm Alpha used to say an alcoholic should either think or drink, but he should never do them both at the same time. Well, I made that fatal error that day. Boy, I was thinking and drinking. And I went home, and I decided I'd get my stuff, and I'd leave. So I did. I got home, and I don't know if we got any leavers in here, and I used to leave every now and then. I wouldn't take everything. You know, just the things you look the cutest in, you know. And, of course, your fishing tackle and your golf club. Essentials. But this time, I was getting it all. And they recognized that. My wife and my son, who was at the time 7, they were just coming in from school. And they recognized what was going on. And as bad a husband and father as I was, as bad as I had treated them, she started crying and she said, "Don't leave us. Do anything, but don't leave us. What are we going to do if you leave us?" My son started the same thing. He said, "Dad, if you leave us, we'll die." And he got down on his hands and knees, and he was holding me around my ankle. And I kicked him loose from my leg and sent him down the hall up against the walls as if he were a mad dog. And I turned around, walked out of that house, never even gave it a thought. In 30 minutes, I was back in that favorite watering hole drinking, and I didn't think about it again until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Never crossed my mind once again. Well, I started really going crazy then. I had absolutely nothing to hold me back then. I'd work as little as possible, enough to keep something to drink, and out in those bars chasing women all day and all night. And I did that for about 3 years. My friends, you know, the best friend, the one you met in the bar last night, they started asking, they were all getting married. And they started asking, "When are you going to get married?" "Oh, I've already been that route, pal. Me and marriage don't get along. I'm never getting married again." And so one day, I was over at the Colonial Country Club in Fort Worth, minding my very own business, sitting in this bar, and the country club, though. And there she was, sitting right over there. Now, if some of you were here today, you heard the other side of this story. She said, when we met, that I had an ugly blonde sitting on my lap. I don't think I've ever had an ugly anything on my lap, but I can't swear to it. It just don't sound like me. But anyway, I asked her for a number. She wouldn't give it to me, so I asked her friend. I said, "Give me her number." So she jotted it down on a match cover and handed it across. She realized what was going on. She said, "I didn't authorize her to give you my number. Let me have it back." I said, "No, well, you're not going out." And we bantered back and forth there a little while, and she said, "All right, big boy, if you want to go out, let's go out tonight." I said, "We can't tonight." She said, "Why not?" I said, "I already got a date." She said, "Break it." I said, "I wouldn't break a date with her to go out with you, and I wouldn't break a date with you to go out with her." Well, she already told you. She thought I had character. Instead, I am one, you know. So, but the next day, we did go out, and a few months later, we did get married. And she said I moved in with her after a week. I think she's pushing that. I don't recall it that way, but I'm not sure. There again. Dear, you may be right. But anyway, we got married, and the day we got married, my oldest son, the one that I had kicked that day, he said he wanted to move in with us, and he did. And no, it wasn't him, it was my daughter, that's who it was. He didn't move in a little bit, a couple of years later. My daughter was the one that wanted to move in with us the day after we got married. So she moved in with us, and alcoholism started breaking out in every corner of our house. Kay had those 2 kids by previous marriage. I had those 3, and we just kind of put them together like a little basket of pups, I guess. And I can't speak for her. I can only speak for myself. But I had no idea how to be a husband or a father. The only thing I knew that I was going to try it different than I did it the first time. I was going to try to do a 180 from what I had done before, because what I did before didn't work. And so I was going to try to do something different. And for the most part, we did. But when that alcoholism started breaking out with those kids, my Lord. By this time, another one of mine had come live, so we got four of them there. My littlest one was still living with his mother. But those four oldest ones, boy, they were giving us some kind of grief. Get a call one day from the high school, over to Hillcrest High School. You have one named Kevin? Well, sure do. Well, come get him. He just set the school building on fire, and he is out of here. So I'd go over and pick him up, take him home. The next day, another school would call. You got one named Stacy? Well, yeah. Well, come get her. She's having that far away feeling again. Well, I knew what that was. I had it a few times. And go get her. The next day, you got one named Darby? Well, yeah. Well, come get him. He just jumped out of the second story window, and he's chasing a rabbit across the football field. Go get him. Next day, the FBI would call. Say, you got one named Stacy and Deidre? Well, yeah. Well, do they know it's a federal offense to make long-distance phone calls and charge them at random to somebody out of the book? And I said, no, but I'll make them aware of it. It was something every single day. And I'd say, Kay, you're going to have to take these calls for the next 2 or 3 days. I just can't do this every day and run it. Get a call of police. You got one named Kevin and Darby? Well, yeah, well, they're in jail. Well, what are they in jail for? Well, they threw a water balloon off a toll road and knocked the windshield out of this classic automobile. I'm thinking, oh, my God, and I'm driving down there and thinking about a Bentley or something. You get down there, and it's a 1960 Dodge Dart. And because it was 25 years old, this lady said it was a classic. And so anyway, we found an old windshield and got it replaced. We were doing something like that all of the time. We didn't know it was alcoholism. She never looked at my drinking. By this time, as she told you earlier today, when I married her, I started doing things different. The other wife, I tried to get away from her every chance I could. But Kay, I took her everywhere I went. We went to 3 Super Bowls, went all over the country, at Mexico, Canada. We took lots of trips, did lots of stuff. And I drank all the time, and she never even looked at my drinking one time because it wasn't a problem for her. I wasn't trying to get away from her. I wasn't trying to pull something over on her eyes. So she never thought about me having a problem. But boy, did she zone in on those 3 kids. Boy, she'd go out and pick one of them up, and I'd stay home and drink. By this time, I was drinking at home mostly. She'd be out chasing one down somewhere, and she'd want to know if I wanted to go with her. No, somebody's got a man to phone. I have another call come in here. Sure up. I'd sit there and drink and man the phones. And I'd catch a phone call, and she'd come through, and I'd say, well, another one's up in the field drunk up here in Louisville. She'd go in, go get that one. And so it was something like that all the time. And until that daughter was a senior in college down at Southwest Texas State, and she called and wanted help. My sister had just asked for help a few days before that. She didn't ask for help. My mother asked for help for her. She was over in the psych ward over in Jackson and taking electrical shock treatments, and we'd come down here to see about her, and we didn't know anything about that. My other sister, just younger than me, had been in AA for 5 years, and we didn't know anything about AA. We was awful glad she'd quit doing some of the things she used to do, but we didn't know it had anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous or not drinking. We just knew she was different than she used to be. But anyway, when we got back from that trip, that daughter called us from college and needed some help, and Kay flew down and checked her out of school. She just, like, 10 days before finishing the first semester, but she dropped all those classes with all A's. We never looked at her because she had made good grades. But she's having her own private hell with alcoholism. And checked her out of that school and brought her home and took her to a treatment center, and then she wound up in Chicago. But she had bulimia as well as alcoholism. And she had been gone a few days, and that second one came to us. He said, if you think that she's got troubles, listen to me. And he'd been drinking and taking so many drugs, one of his legs had been numb for about 6 months, and he was scared to tell anybody. And that was his cue to ask for help. And then the youngest came to us. He said, if you think they got troubles, come look what I'm doing. And we went and looked at him and took him into another treatment center. So within 10 days, 3 of our 5 kids were in treatment, all in different places. I felt kind of good, to tell you the truth. It bothered her a lot, but seemed to me things kind of quieted down when they were all gone. But we'd have to go on those visiting days, you know, and visit them. And we went to the first meeting we went to, the first time we went to visit, they got us off and they said, you're going to have to go to some Al-Anon meetings. if you want to see these kids. If you don't have this little card sign that you've attended an Al-Anon meeting, you can't get in here and see those kids. Well, that's all right. Kay said she still loved them, and I guess she did, so she thought it'd be nice if I'd support her. So I went with her and went down to this Al-Anon meeting, and I didn't identify one thing they said. Some wonderful little gray-haired ladies there. They treated me very nice, but I couldn't identify with them because their husbands were drunk. Well, my husband was fine. Those kids were drunk. You know, I just could not identify what they were talking about. So the last day of that 28-day treatment program that one of those kids were in, this lady came up to me, this counselor. God love her. I wouldn't know if I hit her with my car, but God love her, because she had enough courage to walk up to me, and she already listened to me for about a month. I remember the first night I was there, I told them they'd arrange the dining hall. It wasn't seated, but it wasn't set up right. I gave them little tidbits all that month on what they really should be doing. But she walked up to me that last day of his treatment, and she said, you know, you might benefit from some open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, me? What for? She said, well, you might see what's happened to your kids and how alcoholism has affected your family. If you'll go to enough meetings, you'll hear those stories. I said, are you telling me if I go, it'll help them? She said, exactly. I said, well, if it'll help them, I guess I can go. So I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the last Friday night in November 1986 and went down to the Preston group. And I walked in there with the speaker meeting just like this, and this guy standing up there telling his story. And gosh, he just absolutely nailed me. I was in awe. My mouth, I'm sure, had dropped to the floor. No, I didn't go to Texas A&M. I wasn't no Aggie. No, my daddy wasn't no deacon in the Baptist church, and my mama wasn't a school teacher like his. But some of the other things that he said just nailed me right to the floor. I didn't even know y'all thanked the speaker when it was over. And I ran out, I was the first guy up there, and I was sitting on the back row, and I ran down the aisle, and I ran up there and thanked him. I said, boy, I really enjoyed what you had to say. And then I realized I was up there in front of all those people. Said, oh, my God, they're going to think I'm supposed to be here. And I left. And as I was going down those stairs, I ran to another guy, and I said, when do they have this again? He said, well, they have another one just like this on Sunday morning. Sunday morning, 11 o'clock, man, I'm back up those stairs. Another guy from Arkansas talking. Yeah, much younger than me and this other fellow that talked that Friday night. But I understood what he said, too. Totally different life, totally different lifestyle. But I identified with those feelings. And identified with the things that happened to him. So I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous two or three times a week while I still drank. I went to meetings for 22 months and still drank. I drank nearly every day. See, what I figured out after a few meetings, I'm a quick study, and I figured y'all out after about four or five meetings. What you did is you quit drinking vodka and gin and scotch, and you drank a little beer and wine with your food. That's what you did, because I'd hear you say, let's go down and eat some Mexican food after the meeting. Well, you can't eat Mexican food and not drink beer. I knew that. Or they'd say, let's go have some barbecue. Well, you can't eat barbecue and not drink beer. I knew that. So what I thought you did is you drank a little beer and wine with your food. So that's what I did every day. I drank a little beer with my food. I'd come home at night, and Kay said, let's go out and eat. Fine, where you want to eat? She said, well, where'd you go eat today? I said, well, I ate at El Phoenix, at the Mexican food joint. She said, that's kind of what I wanted. I said, well, that's fine. We can go back there. But I'd go in there and I'd get me about six of them great old big bowls of that cold beer with that ice on the outside of the glass. You could peel it off underneath your fingernails. Oh, just know what I'm talking about. My mouth's watering right now. Just thinking about it. But I do that every day. And promptly gained 30 pounds. And one day, I was... The little lights started to come on. The little buzzes here now. I was having lunch with a friend of mine. He's not in the program. You know when somebody's looking at you, like you got something on your tie, your shirt. He's looking across at me, and I said, what is it? He said, I don't know. He said, I've just never seen anybody eat chicken fried steak, mashed potatoes, and gravy, and green beans, and cornbread, and drink beer. And come to think of it, I hadn't either. And that's what I was doing. I was drinking beer with everything I ate. Well, right after the first year, January 87, I had gone and got a physical. And this doctor, after he called, he said after he had these results in 2 or 3 days, he'd give me a call. I said, well, fine. So he called me up. He said, I need you to come down to my office right now. I said, what is it? We can't talk about this on the phone. He said, oh, no. I want you down here in my office. I want to look at you right in the eyes. I told Kay, I said, well, I'll be dead before I get to his office. It's probably the big C, something like that. You know, he wants me down there where he can give me a sedative because what he's going to tell me is going to be so bad. She said, well, God, if it's that bad, I better go with you. So she went down there to his office with him. We sat across his desk. He had these charts and graphs and a bunch of test results that he had done. He said, I got some good news and some bad news. What you want first? I said, give me the good news, I guess. He said, okay, you got diabetes. Well, I didn't know what diabetes was. Not really. I'd heard the term, but I didn't really know what it was. And I said, well, if that's good news, what's the bad news? He said, he looked at me and he just closed his folder and he said, how much do you drink? I said, I drink a couple every day. Standard answer, isn't it? And he's not the first doctor that told me this, but he's the first time anybody told me this, I knew that they meant it. He said, he looked at me and he said, I don't care how much you drink. He said, let me tell you something, what's going to happen to you. You keep on drinking with this diabetes, and he said, you're going to come back in here one of these days, we're going to have to take off a foot, or a leg, or remove a kidney. And he leaned across his desk and looked over his glasses, and he said, or you may never, ever be able to make love again. At that moment, you people had what I wanted, and I was willing to go to any length to get it. And I didn't have anything to drink for about 2 weeks. And I promptly started drinking again. All the while going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Loving you people, loving what you said, and identifying with what was going on with you. But I was just wasn't that bad. I'd only been in jail one time. I heard a guy talk one time, he'd been in jail 116 times. I thought, wow, I've only been in jail once. Well, let me tell you something. It's not a requirement, this program, that you go to jail. A lot of us have, but it's not necessary. I never had done a lot of, I hadn't laid on the sidewalk and puked straight up before. I've stood up a lot and puked. I could stand up and puke, not even get any on my shoes. I get some on your shoes. I could puke from a moving automobile, not get any on the car. I mean, I had lots of experience with that, but I was different. I'd never been kicked out of the Army. Of course, I've never been to the Army. But all those yets were I was running over in my mind, you know. I hadn't done this and I hadn't done that. I never even had a DWI. God, I used to say that with such pride. After I was going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't say I was an alcoholic now, mind you. But I'd say things like, when I'd get a chance to, well, I've never even had a DWI. One night this guy came up to me, he said, I've heard you say that you've never had a DWI. Is that right? I said, that's right, buddy. I never had one. He said, let me ask you a question. He said, have you ever been stopped by the police while drinking and you should have had a DWI? I said, oh, yeah, lots of times. He said, let's count them. So I started figuring them up, and we quit at 16. And number 14, 15, and 16 was all in the same day, twice by the same cop. I got 3 tickets that day, but I didn't go to jail, and I don't know why. I was just one of those guys that I could straighten up for just a few seconds when I had to. Some of you may identify with that. I could always straighten up for just a little while if I had to. Well, I knew, I could feel that family, this family, the second family, slipping away. I could feel my wife slipping away. Y'all were doing something to her at these Al-Anon meetings. I kind of quit going. I just got a little fed up with all this program talk and and the alcohol I was taking in every day, it just wasn't jiving. I couldn't come and look at y'all. I just felt bad about coming to your meetings and still drinking. So I just kind of laid low for a while. She didn't. She kept going to meetings every day, sometimes 2 and 3 meetings a day. And I tried everywhere in the world I could get her to quit going to those danged old meetings. And I remember one night she came in from a meeting, and I was awful upset. I had told her a few nights before that I tried these kind of tricks. I'd say, you wanted to go to that new movie. Well, I'll take you to that movie tonight. She said, I'd love to go to that movie, but it'll have to be before or after my meeting. The next night, I said, that new restaurant's opening. Do you want to go to? I'd like to take you to that restaurant. She said, I'd love to go, but it'll have to be before or after my meeting. So she came home a meeting one night. I heard the car go in the garage, and I heard her open the back door, and I'm going down the back hallway, and I meet her about halfway down the hall. I said, let me tell you something. I said, you are making me very unhappy. And she looked at me with those cold, Al-Anon eyes, and she said, I am not responsible for your happiness. Oh. Made me so mad, I went to me. I stormed out of the house. I went down to this group, went in there, and the first guy I saw, I said, you know what she said to me tonight? I told him, she's right. She's not responsible. I was going to talk to you. I went and talked to this guy. So I went over there and talked to this guy. I said, you know what she said to me tonight? And I told him, he said, oh, man, she's right. Get a life or something like that. I want to talk to him. I need to talk to a woman. A woman will understand what I'm saying. I looked in there in this Al-Anon room. I didn't know it was the Al-Anon room at that time. There's a little gray-headed lady standing there. I said, I don't think you'll talk to her. So I walked, sidled up to her, and I said, you know what she said to me? And I told her, and she patted me on the legs, pulled me by the britches leg down in the chair beside her. And she kind of patted me, and I told her what she had said. And she said, honey, she's right. She's not responsible for your happiness. You are. It felt just like somebody had poked a pin in my balloon and the last bit of air was coming out of me. I knew that if I didn't do something different than I was doing, that I was going to lose her and that other family. And I just wasn't willing to pay that price. I knew from that doctor telling me, if you don't quit drinking, what's going to happen to you? Because my pancreas wasn't working. So I went to a meeting the next night and got me a desire chip, and that was August 27th of 1988. And from that day to this, I haven't had a drink of alcohol, nor have I even really thought about taking a drink. And things haven't been all great and all roses since that time. We've had, like everybody else, we've had death. We've had all kinds of financial upsets and upheavals, children, things happening to them that before I certainly would have drank over. Nothing has happened that I thought taking a drink would make it better. And I was so fortunate when I got here. Got around a bunch of old timers. God, I love the old timers. I'm glad the old timers with a lot of time are here tonight. Where would I be if it weren't for the old timers? If the old-timers, when I came in, had been like some of the people I see today who come in and get theirs and then leave and say, I don't owe anybody anything, I've got mine. Where would I be if the old-timers thought that when I walked in the door? I guarantee you'd have another speaker tonight. But they cared about me when I didn't want to be cared about. They took me places when I didn't want to go. They'd say things to me like, come on, we're going to go over here Friday night. I don't want to go over here. We don't care. Get in the car. We're going over here. So I'd get in the car with them. And we'd go over there and we'd hear this speaker. And next Friday night, they said, we're going to go here. I don't really want to go. Well, we're going to have this this new steakhouse. Well, I like steak. I didn't hear it. I didn't put it together. They were going to probably take me to a meeting afterwards. But I wondered, why are we eating at 5:30? We'd go eat a steak and then they'd take me to the meeting. And God, I loved it. I absolutely loved it after a while. I didn't at first. They'd take me to conferences. One old guy said, give me $50. I said, for what? We're going to an AA conference this weekend, and you're going to go, and it costs $50. Let me have it. I gave it to him. And we went, and I'm glad it did because it changed my sobriety. Because I got around a bunch of people who were living this program. People weren't just sitting around meetings and talking about it, but you could see it in their eyes and in their actions that they were living the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And God loved it. I went everywhere with them. And my sobriety really started to take hold and start to mean something. One of those old-timers became my sponsor. God, he was one of the most spiritual people that I've ever known in my life. And he died a few years ago of lung cancer. He had couple months short of 32 years of continued sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I loved him. He was a guy that took the time with me. He was a guy who never, ever gave me a directive that I needed to do something by a certain time. He was too busy being an example. He was the kind of guy that you want to do things with and for just because it's the right thing to do. I remember just a few weeks before he died, I went down to see him, and he'd been pretty heavily sedated for several days because the cancer had gotten all in his ribs and his backbone, and it was just he was just eating up with it. But he was pretty lucid that day, and I went in and sat on the side of his bed, and he had those clear, sparkling blue eyes, and he looked up at me, and I said, "Jack, I got to ask you something." I said, "At a time like this, has fear returned to you yet?" And without hesitation, he said, "No, not a bit." I said, "How, at a time like this, when you're so close, how can you sit here and say that fear has not consumed you?" He said, "Oh, that's easy. Because I believe God is who he says he is." And I knew he meant that. I can't tell you how much strength I gained from that man that day. He said, "You know, my old body's wearing out." He said, "God made it that way." He said, "But my spirit's going to soar." And it does. I feed him at every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I go to. And his spirit does soar. He loved Alcoholics Anonymous. 5 days before he went into that bed for the last 2 weeks, he was going to meetings every 5 days a week, every morning. Couldn't drive any longer. Somebody had to go by and pick him up. He could just barely pull his oxygen cart. But he loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and he would go every day. So the guys I sponsor, they know not to call me and say, "I think I'm going to stay home and watch a rerun of Seinfeld tonight." Because they know I will not be impressed, because they all know that story. And that would not impress me to miss a meeting or something like that when my old sponsor was almost dying, taking his last breath and still going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He gave me a sense of God that I had never known. He showed me a spiritual way of life that I never, ever, ever knew existed. Some of those kids we talked about, my oldest daughter, she got married the first time. I was still drinking. She had a huge, big church wedding. Big Catholic church. Not only did I not get to go and walk her down the aisle, she expressly asked me not to come. "Don't be there." And so I didn't go. Unfortunately, that marriage, or fortunately, whatever it may be, I'm not the judge of that, didn't work out. And after a few years, she got a divorce. And she had that one child out of that marriage. A few years later, she got remarried. And by this time, I had made those amends because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she and her husband had just gotten married and moved over to South Carolina. And she had no sooner gotten there, found out she was pregnant with twins. And these babies were going to come early. It was apparent she'd had some very difficult low blood pressure problems, and she was having a very difficult time with that pregnancy, and her husband was out of town. And her blood pressure got so low, it was dangerously low, they decided to put her in the hospital and take the babies. She was about 7 months. So she called. She's there by herself, so she called, our youngest one had been out of our life for 6 years, hadn't seen him, talked to him. He had just come back in our life and was sleeping at our house for a few days. He'd been sleeping in his car for a while.
And he'd come back and wanted to get out of the elements, and we let him in for a while. And anyway, he was at our house that day when the call came. And he answered the phone. You know how they are when they leave, and all of a sudden they come back, they think the phone, the refrigerator, everything's theirs. And so the phone rang, and he's on it like a duck on a June bug, and it was her. And they conversed for a few seconds, and she told him she wanted to talk to me. So I get on the phone with her, and she tells me what's going on. And she's in the hospital, fixing to go into the delivery room just a few minutes. And she was scared. And she was by herself. And I could tell she was trembling on the other end of that phone. I said, honey, why don't we just pray? And so I prayed with her over the phone. First time that I can ever recall praying with my daughter, since maybe she's a little thing. And we got through praying, and I said, when the thing is over, give my number to the nurse and ask her if she would please call me and tell me, give me a report how y'all are doing, and just tell her to call me Clay. And so she did, and the nurse called about an hour later. The babies were okay, and my daughter was in stable condition, so things were looking good. So about a week later, she's getting ready to go home from the hospital, and so she calls back. That son was still there. He grabs the phone again. I hadn't shared with him mine and her conversation the week before. And he was admonishing her for not speaking to him for just a few seconds on that first phone call. I knew who it was, so I picked up the extension, and just about the time she's saying, Kyle, I was in trouble, and I needed my daddy. It's the first time I can recall her saying that since she was about 6 years old. When I was out drunk one night, and she had dropped a can out of the pantry and hit her on the big toe and had a huge blood blister under that nail. She wouldn't go to the emergency room, and she just screamed until I got home about 4 in the morning so I could drill a hole in that toenail. I was the only one she let anybody touch it. That's the same girl that asked me not to be at her first wedding because she couldn't stand what I had done and what I had become. And let me tell you something. That doesn't happen without the program to this alcoholic, without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the power and the people and the power and the steps and the power of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I owe everything I have to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. A few years ago, there was this rabbi. He was teaching a graduate course at the University of California at Berkeley. And he one day was in class, and one of the grad students said, Rabbi, I have a question. He said, fine, what is it? What is a blessing? The rabbi thought for a second, and he stroked his beard, and he said, when God created the universe, he did so in 6 days. He made earth, moon, and stars, and he looked at what he had made and said, this is good. And then he made horses and cows and pigs and goats and looked at what he had made and said, this is good. Then he made fish and peas and lettuce and looked at what he had made and said, this is good. The sixth day, he made man. He said nothing. Are there any conclusions? One guy said, yeah, people are no good. He said, well, that's a possible conclusion, but it's a bad translation. You see, in the English language, good means many things. Have a good day, a good apple, a good book, for a good time call. Means lots of different things. But in Hebrew, which is the language God spoke, he looked at what he had made and said, this is Tov. T-O-V. What is Tov, you ask? Tov means something is whole. Tov means something is complete. Tov means something is entire. Tov means things are exactly the way they're supposed to be. They can't be any other way. So God looked at what he had made and said, this is Tov. He made horses and cows and pigs and goats, Tov. He made fish and peas and lettuce, Tov. But people were not born complete. people were born full of holes and full of broken areas with lots of jaggedness. So what are you supposed to do? Well, in the course of a lifetime, you're supposed to fill in some of the holes. You're supposed to rub smooth some of the jaggedness, fill in around the broken areas. You're born male, you're supposed to grow into men. You're born female, you're supposed to grow into women. You're supposed to grow into real, live human beings. Then your rabbi paused and he said, but as we live life's journey, as we walk our path, anything that gets in front of us and drags us forward, anything that gets behind us and pushes us ahead, anything that gets deep down inside of us where it's cold and it's dark and it's damp and there's no air there and there's no light there, and it kicks and it pushes and it shoves till there is air there, till there is light there. Anything that does that is a blessing. And sometimes blessings don't feel good. Sometimes we don't even know they're blessings until years later we look back on a situation we thought at the time would absolutely kill us. Turns out it opened doors that we never even knew were there. And when I heard that story, I understood about my alcoholism. Something I thought was a curse, something I thought was the absolute worst thing could ever happen to somebody, turned out about to be one of the greatest blessings that I've ever been given. It's because of Alcoholics Anonymous, people like you, and a God that I understand today. And but for the grace of God, I could have missed it all. Thank you.